I want to go back one page to something that I left out of your, I think I left it out of your handout. I did. Yeah, I did. We talked about this brain, right? One thing we didn't talk about was that our brain has two sides to it, the right and the left side. I don't think that's in there. I didn't put that in. It says just right to left, right? Yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't say like right and left hemisphere, right? I don't think so. Yeah, okay. Does it say lateralized? That's the part. Let's talk about that for a second. Okay, real briefly. We're going to go back. Are we okay with this? We're rewind the tape? Just a second. So if you notice, when you have your hand here and your brain is here, you notice that you have a right side and a left side. Have people known this before, that you have a right side of your brain and a left side of your brain? And you may have learned that the right side of your brain does certain things and the left side of your brain tends to do certain things. Okay? Now, all these statements are generalized. They're generalized, but I just want to, we'll share some of these things with you. So your right, one of the things that your right does is that it's in charge of, in general, like visual spatial orientation. My right brain is largely those neurons that are responsible for my awareness of where I am in space are in my right brain. A lot of what emerges as emotion emerges in my right brain. A lot of what emerges as what we would call an integrated map of the body emerges in my right brain. What do we mean by an integrated map of the body? The sense that if I'm feeling something in my stomach, that I even know that it's there, is running to my right brain. Timelessness is in my right brain. You had the idea that like when you're doing something that you're really dialed in with and you're having a lot of fun, like you look up and 2 hours have gone by and you have no sense of the passage of time. Right? That's because a lot of what you've been doing has been concentrated in your right brain. Nonverbal cues come into your right brain. Now, there's an interesting little idea. It's suggested that anywhere from 60 to 90% of all human communication takes place nonverbally. Nonverbally. Think about the amount of communication that is getting done, whether you want it to get done or not, because of the 7 things nonverbally that you do. You have eye contact, you have tone of voice, you have facial expression, you have body language, you have gestures, and you have timing and intensity of responses. Those 7 nonverbal cues make up anywhere from 60 to 90% of everything you are doing to communicate to people with whom you're engaged. So you know how this goes, right? Where she says, well, you said, and he said, no, I did not. Because what came out of his mouth and what he meant were 2 different things. And he's kind of a literal guy. And he's like, look, I'm a left brain guy. And I went to this conference where Kurt Thompson was speaking, and we learned that in the left brain, those things that are logical and linear and literal and language-based are largely in your left brain. I was speaking to you out of my left brain, honey, and what I said is exactly what I meant. But she was listening to all his nonverbal tone that was saying something very, very different. Again, these are things that our brains will pay attention to whether or not we are paying attention to the fact that they're paying attention to them or not. And so what is it like for me to love God and to love my neighbor with all of my mind if most of my mind is communicating with my neighbor in ways that I'm not paying attention to? But that's not the only thing. What does it mean for me to love God if the imagery that I have of God is one only of disappointment? That's a nonverbal cue. Do you know that? We'd like to think that God talks to us in the Bible, and mostly that's how it happens, or he talks to us when somebody preaches. Look, God talks to us in our own brains, but a lot of that is wrapped up in the imagery that we have of God. And it may not be the God of the Bible who's actually in your head. Does that make sense? And we have friends with whom we want them to know Jesus. And the only Jesus they know was connected to their dad, who was a deacon at the church and who beat the living crap out of them at night. That's nonverbal stuff. It's really hard to get through. So we see that a lot of what's also taking place in the brain is not just what's taking place from bottom to top, but from right to left. And we'll notice eventually how relationships tend to help us be aware and functionally integrate some of those things more so than we integrate other things. Sometimes to our advantage, but many times to our disadvantage if we're not paying that much attention to what we are leaving out. So, bottom to top, right to left. Now, bullet number four, this idea of, you see that bullet, integration? Ready to go there? You see that? So you're the owner of a company. And your company is doing really, really well. And your company has several different divisions in it. And you have a marketing division and a sales division and a R&D division and an executive division. And you want that company to flourish. And so there are two ways that companies that have multiple divisions flourish. And one way is this. That each of those divisions needs to be fully capitalized. Each of those divisions need to be able to do what it wants to do and do that really, really well. So you have to make sure that the salespeople get as much training as they can get, that the marketing people get as much ideas as they can get. You want to fully invest in these different divisions. Because if they don't do well, they're not going to work, right? That's what we would call differentiation. Each of these divisions is going to differentiate. It's going to grow in maturity to do exactly what it was meant to do at its best. But the other thing that that company is going to need to do in order to flourish is that each of these divisions is going to need to be able to talk to the other divisions. Somebody's going to have to make sure that these guys are talking to one another. Because I can have great salespeople who are selling things I'm not even making. Right? We want differentiation, but we also want linkage. We also want linkage. We want to be able to strengthen and mature every part of the mind's activity. We want to know that we can do emotion well. We want to know that we think well. We want to know that we're connected to our bodies well. We want to know that we're connected to other people well. Those are all differentiated assignments that we have. But we also need to know that those different functions are connected to one another in our own mind. So, it was one of those rare days when I was actually up on a Saturday morning. My wife was sleeping. Our daughter, who was about two at the time, the plan was I was going to get downstairs and take care of some work in the kitchen, let my wife sleep, and it was going to be a great day because I was going to be the hero because I was going to get up, I'll be up with our daughter, so forth and so on, right? And my wife was just going to sleep. And the next thing I know, I'm standing in the kitchen. We have those little play school, like, cassette tape players that little kids used to have. And, you know, if you're 2 or 3 or 4 years of old, like you can just pop a tape in and push the button and go. Well, it's like 7:30 and my daughter decides she's going to play music at the top of the steps and she's come singing, bouncing down the steps. And of course, this is not according to Kurt's plan because I wanted my wife to sleep. I didn't want any of this mess. And I lost my mind by the time she got to the kitchen. By the time she got to the kitchen, like, I'm now yelling at my daughter. Okay, now, me, the guy who wants the house to be quiet, I'm yelling at my daughter. Things are going from bad to worse. It was one of those moments where I was not very well integrated. I was really disconnected from the stuff that I was feeling, the stuff that I was thinking, and all these things rushing around at once with me not paying very much attention to what I was doing. And before you know it, not only have I awakened my wife, but I've also really hurt my daughter. This is what disintegrated states do. Disintegrated states leave a trail of broken relationships in their wake. And we've all got them. And maybe they're distant enough now that we don't have to think about them or pay that much attention to them because we haven't talked to our brother in 5 years. Or we just kind of keep our parents at emotional arm's length. Or we just make sure that we sit way on the other side of that person who's on the other side of the church. We sit way on the other side of the church from them because, well, we had that conversation, you know, 6 months ago, and they're not coming to apologize. I'm not in the wrong, so I'm not talking to them either. I'm sure that never happens here. But you know what I mean? Like, this is the world we live in. This is the world that Jesus has come to transform. He didn't come to transform some plastic planet. He came to transform this one, where we really live, where we really yell at our daughters in our attempt to keep our wife quiet. He came for me, who was losing his mind in the kitchen. This is what it means for us to be disintegrated. But what does it mean for us to be really differentiated and really linked? What does it mean for us to be integrated? So in the 86th Psalm, there's this beautiful verse. Now, you know, one of the things about the Psalms that really I think is kind of cool, is literature are the Psalms? It's poetry, right? It's poetry and hymns, right? It's these songs. Poetry is largely what it is. And one of the interesting things about poetry is that it is a beautiful way of integrating your brain because it uses language, right? A logical linear processor, right? It uses that part of myself that goes through things linearly. But it also does it in a format that catches me by surprise. Do you love poetry where you're writing a part of a sentence and then it just like drops off the cliff and it comes back to the next sentence and it really catches you by surprise? This is what poetry does. And this is what the Psalms do all the time. It's as if somewhere somebody was thinking that the Psalms are a great way to bring the right and your left brain together. It's a beautiful thing. All those neuroscientists that were part of the canonizing feature back making the Old Testament bring together. In the 86th Psalm, we read this. Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may walk in your truth. Create in me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. Teach me your way that I may walk in your truth. Notice that way is not just a set of logical linear commands. What does it mean to be in the way? What does it mean to be walking? What does it mean to be moving? This is not unlike what we talk about the mind. The mind is always moving. It's a process. What does it mean for me to be in God's way, walking with him? Teach me your way that I may what? Walk in your truth. Truth is not a thing to be obtained. It is not a thing that we hold on to. It is a thing we become. It is a living, breathing person. His name is Jesus. He's always moving, always changing, always redeeming. But you know, I got to tell you, anybody here know anybody who likes things to be just so? Anybody here that person who likes to be just so? You might be that person. Well, you know, in my left brain, I like to know that things are right. Anybody here like things to be right? Especially as we remember in those conversations that I was right about what I said. I like truth to be right. In fact, I'd like gospel truth to be right. I don't necessarily feel as comfortable with the gospel truth being about a person. Because people can move. Jesus can move. He can ask me questions. You see, I thought I had the truth in Jesus neatly packaged and wrapped. And then he asked me this other question. I didn't see that one coming. Because he's going in to find other parts of my mind that I didn't know I didn't know I had. This is what it means to be renewed. We think renewal is going to be a party. I tell people, you know, every time God renews your mind, it's like he does have a party. He comes in and he says, what's your name?
Kelly,
right. Kelly, I just want to tell you, it has been so great to have you in this part of the journey. And here are all the ways we're really proud of you. And this is great. We're having a party. And he says, and now, Kelly, here's the next part of the journey. And he announces the next hard thing you're going to have to do. He's doing this all the time. He comes, he finds parts of us. He's moving. He's not a truth thing that I can grasp. He's not a thing that I get to control. He's not a thing that I get to hang on to. But my brain, when left to itself, will want to logically, linearly fix things to be one way and one way only. It's not just about faith. It's about like where things belong in the kitchen. Right? Things have to have their proper place. And I say, I agree. Their proper place is anywhere it happens to find a space. Other people don't necessarily agree with this. They think there's only one place, and if it moves like an inch, right? I'm thinking Prozac, baby. That's what I'm thinking. Like if you have to move, like, you know, no, one inch, it needs to move right there. Right, so we know at times that we can be so interested in things being right about truth that we fail to see that truth is about movement. Create within me an undivided heart. The second half of this verse. Create within me an undivided heart. We have all these different divisions. And by heart in this Jewish text, we're really talking about the mind, the soul, the everything. My thoughts, my feelings, my impulses. The parts about me that I remember but that I'm ashamed of. And I'd really rather not talk to anybody about that because I'm too ashamed to talk about it. For us to be integrated is for us to have undivided hearts. And to the degree that my heart will be undivided within me is going to be reflected in the degree to which I'm also living in a community that is willing to be undivided. And by undivided in the community, I don't mean that people never disagree. I mean that people, even when they disagree, are never going to leave. We get to the end of our time today. We're going to talk about what it means to be in a part of a healing community. And healing communities are not ones who never disagree. They're communities in which people don't leave. And we have the impulse to leave. Prone to wander, right? We will leave. And as we will see, this comes right out of the Garden of Eden. I have parts of me that I would rather get rid of and have them leave. Parts of what represent my mind. I don't want any part of that. I don't, and mostly, I don't want you asking me questions that's going to bring that to my mind either, frankly, very much. What are the parts of us that we would really rather leave? And where are we tempted to leave those in my community, and where, even more so, have I felt left? We've all got them. None of these will be stones that Jesus will leave unturned. You can count on it. All right, we have 45 minutes. You okay? I know you've been sitting. Okay, let's try something. Let's everybody stand up. All right, this gentleman right here in the jacket's got the right idea because this is where we're going. Now, I know that we're standing kind of on a little bit of an angle, but I'm going to ask you to do the following. If you can, it's a little hard when you're in pews, but I'm going to ask you to, first of all, just start to do this. All right. And now... Okay, everybody else starts to go to the bathroom. This is the moment. I can see them. Look, they're all going. They're going. Like, he won't notice. We're all standing up. I have my chance to make a break for it. It's awesome. Okay, now do this. All right? Now do this. Okay. All right, good. Now, here's the tricky part, because you're standing in pews. Here's the tricky part. Now, I want you to turn around. Turn around while you're doing it. All right? Father Abraham, right? All right, okay. All right. This is really amazing for me to watch you all doing this. This is just, okay. All right, so now when you're ready, you can have a seat or make a quick dash to the bathroom. All right, now let me ask, what do you feel? Energized, energy, what else? Slightly dizzy. Slightly dizzy. Anything else? You feel connected to the other people that did it with you. Right, because, now, okay, now in our culture, well, ours, you know, kind of North American culture, now, most of the time, like at lunch break in your company where you work, you probably don't see a lot of people doing this around the water cooler, right? You probably only don't see a lot of people. Now, if we lived in a culture where this was routine, you know, doing this in here would not be that big of a deal. But it's a little silly. It's a little different. We have very different thoughts about the people who went to the bathroom, don't we? And when they come back, they're coming right up here. And they're going to do a little exercise for us, aren't they? Now, there comes the first. There she comes. She has no idea what's about to befall her. Very good. Nicely done. Okay, so we do feel connected. And I want you, but we feel energized, we feel lightheaded if we're a little dehydrated. Oh, but here's the thing. Isn't it striking what we sense and feel because of what we've done with our bodies? We move. We've been sitting still, and we move, and the nature of what we feel changes. How many times in the Gospels does Jesus, in the course of healing someone, necessarily involve movement? Stretch out your hand. Go, your servant will be healed. Even the woman who came to him for her bleeding has to come to him. Healing is always going to involve movement. Integration. An undivided heart is always going to involve movement. We're going to talk later about shame, and we're going to see how what shame does is ratchet everything down to stasis, to not moving at all. Sin is largely about the lack of movement. One of its incorporated features is how we do not move when we are in its grip. Integration is about movement. Healing is about movement. Following Jesus is about following. It's about movement. Create in me an undivided heart that I may fear your name. And that fear is translated in terms of walking in your truth. Next part. You'll see us, we've written there a thing called the nine domains of integration. Now this is where, yes? Thank you. You know, it's always great to have somebody in the back moving, waving his arms when I'm like, when I'm not paying attention to what I'm paying attention to. So here is the FACES is an acronym that we use that gives us an idea of when we are in an integrated state. It stands for five words: flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, stable. Flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, stable. Now, we could pick a range of different words. But these would be words that we can step back and say, look, if I just use this acronym, two or three times a day, I can stop myself and say, gosh, To what degree does my life represent this acronym of FACES? How flexible am I being? How flexible do I feel? How adaptive am I becoming at the moment? I'm in a difficult situation at work. What's my level of being able to be adaptive? Coherent. We're going to talk more about that in just a minute, about what we mean by that word coherent. Meaning, mostly, am I able to understand the situation and my story in it for its fullness? Like, what is really going on here? Because so much of our storytelling and our understanding of our lives misses large chunks of what our mind actually involves. Energized. How energized do I feel? What am I doing to remain in unenergized states or to do something to change that? And stable. Am I feeling comfortable? Am I feeling safe? Flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, stable. Now, this next section is where a lot of the meat is in terms of these different forms of our mind's activity that we want to call toward integration. And you'll see what we mean by them as we move through them. If I want to love God with all my mind, what are the different domains of the mind? So we've got all these neurons with both a triune brain and a right and left brain that are functioning 100 billion neurons strong with all these synapses. And as it turns out, the different ways, the different kinds of functions that the brain provides for us, this is one way to think about what those functions are, these nine different domains of the mind's activity. And we want to ask ourselves the question, to what degree am I loving God with all of these nine domains? So here's the first. Consciousness. This presumes that everybody here in the room is conscious. And what do we mean by that? Well, there are a lot of people who are awake. And there are a lot of people who are awake and who also happen to be alert. Not everybody who's awake is alert. I know it's been a long night, long morning already, hasn't it? Yeah, it's okay. But it's altogether different for me to be awake and alert and attuned. For me to be attuned to what I'm sensing, what I'm imaging, what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking. That my attention mechanism is actually paying attention to what is taking place right here where I am. Many of you already this morning, while we've been in this room doing this thing together that we're doing, have been someplace else. You know who you are. You've been someplace prior to this morning, or you've been someplace later on today. And it's okay. But it means you're not here. And the reality is, we spend a lot of our waking hours living someplace else other than where we are. Imagine what kind of life we could live if we actually showed up where our feet were. Yeah? Think of the energy we burn living a life out there in the future that's never going to happen because we don't have it. This is the only time you've got. Here's a question. How well are you paying attention to what you're paying attention to? This is what consciousness really boils down to. How well am I paying attention to what I'm paying attention to? Important to know that attention is what I call the engine that pulls the train of the mind, or it's the ignition key of the mind. Either of those metaphors work. Nothing we do we do, without a shift in our attention. Whether that's voluntary or involuntary, my attention is constantly shifting. The question is whether or not other parts of my brain that are in charge of it quite automatically and non-consciously, are those the parts of my brain that are running my attention, or are you in charge of your attention? Most of what creates trouble for us has everything to do with the fact that we're not paying attention to what we're paying attention to. Most of our brain is just running on autopilot. Loving God? Are you kidding? How do you do that if you're not paying attention to what you're paying attention to? And the reason we start with this is because all of these other domains will fall under the light that is shined on them by your attentional mechanism. And so we can't really talk about any of these other things if your attention is not able to be directed toward them. One of the reasons why we give people exercises like the 6 breath per minute exercise and like meditation exercises is, as we said earlier, it helps you practice strengthening that attentional mechanism. It's like going to the gym to do workout in order for you to be a better basketball player, or be a better tennis player. You're not going into the gym just to go to the gym. You're going to the gym in order for you to strengthen what you really want to do on the court. That's number one, consciousness. Number two, our horizontal. And we've talked about this, that right and left part of the brain. How well are we paying attention to our nonverbal cues? So if you're sitting with somebody, you know what happens when they do this to you. What is this? This is usually a universal sign of what? I'm closed. Leave me alone. Or I'm in Saskatoon and I'm freezing, right? Right, so here's the thing. Here's something we don't often recognize. We're sitting with somebody, and if we're the ones who are crossing our arms, crossing our legs, I don't really want to talk to you, we're sending them a message. But here's something else that we're doing. We're sending ourselves the same message. You notice that my brain is sensing what my body is doing. And so I'm not just sending somebody else a nonverbal cue. I'm sending my own brain a nonverbal cue. I am saying to me, this person with whom I am sitting is not safe. This person with whom I am sitting is not okay to talk to. I'm not okay to open up to this person at this point. You see what I mean? Our brains are not just talking to others. They're talking to us as well. But what if I'm not paying attention to that? What if I'm not paying attention to this part of my nonverbal cue? Or what if I'm not paying attention to what I'm imaging? Right, we have all kinds of images that do strange things to us. So if you've had a fight with your spouse in the morning and you go off to work, but during the time you've been at work, you've been so distracted that you forget about the fight. And throughout your day, you're not necessarily thinking about that very much. And your day's actually been a pretty good day at work. And then it comes time to go home. And then you think, I'm going home to my spouse. And then the image in your mind that comes crowding back in is the fight that you had in the morning. You haven't thought about it since 4 o'clock 2 hours ago. And you see what happens. Suddenly, the image that I have in my mind starts to generate in my mind that my spouse, and you know where this goes. But am I paying attention to the fact that I'm actually doing something in my mind that is separate from, like, I don't know what my spouse is doing. I mean, for all I know, my spouse could be at home waiting for me to get home because she's really sorry about what happened. But I'm making up this story as I go. I'm creating all, like, frankly, it's really kind of tough for me to love God with my mind and be pissed at my spouse at the same time. It doesn't mean you can't do it, right? So we can practice doing these things together, but, like, it's harder to do. You follow me? So how well am I paying attention to that? When I'm using language, when I'm using tone of voice, when I'm using any of these things that are my right and my left domain, this domain, am I attuning to what I'm actually doing? Most of us have been doing most of this stuff all of our lives, and we have no idea that we're doing it. It's just pretty automatic, just kind of like running out the door. This takes effort to pay attention to that. Next, we talk about this vertical domain. We've talked about the horizontal domain, the vertical domain. We've already talked about this. This triune brain. Am I paying attention to my body? Am I paying attention to my heart rate? Am I paying attention to these other things, to my body that is the temple of the Holy Spirit? And vicariously, am I then listening to God's voice as it speaks to me in my sweaty palms, trying to get my attention? So there are things that I also want to attune to. If that limbic circuitry is starting to give me emotional states, what am I doing about that? How am I attuning to this? And am I able to put that to language? Third, memory. I guess this is fourth. Memory. So when we talk about memory, we could say that, first of all, there are whole institutions that are dedicated to doing research on memory. There are volumes and volumes and volumes of stuff written on this topic. In general, though, there are two forms of memory that we like people to be aware of. The first is what we call implicit memory, and the second is what we call explicit memory. Here's the first, implicit. Some rules of the game for implicit memory. You don't have to pay attention in order to remember things implicitly, and you don't have to pay attention in order to recall things implicitly. You don't have to pay attention. We'll see why that's important. The second thing is, implicit memory involves remembering things like sensations and images and feelings. It doesn't necessarily really involve remembering events. Implicit memory, many researchers believe, is already actively engaged before you're born. How many here remember when they learned, if you learned how to ride a bike, how many here remember when you learned how to ride a bike, or about the same, about the age that you did? Okay, we got a show of hands. How many of you here learn when, how many remember when you learned how to eat? I mean, at all. Okay. It's because the part of your brain that needs to remember time travel wasn't really online yet. But interestingly enough, I'm guessing that, like, you learned how to eat, remembered how to, you didn't forget that from one meal to the next, right? We just remember, but we don't think about remembering how to eat. Here's another example. If you now ride a bike, if you've gone away from that for a number of years and you come back on, how hard do you have to work to remember how to ride a bike? You don't. You just get on the bike and go because your body remembers. But what about this story? We've seen now that implicit memory can be things that we do with our bodies or things we do with eating. He was 12 when his dad decided that he was going to get sober. He'd been an angry drinking man. But when he decided to get sober, he wasn't really as clear about getting into recovery. And so now he was just an angry non-drinking man. And every day that this boy would come home, he learned, one day especially when his dad wasn't home, when he went out to ride his bicycle, his dad came home and in his angry tirade, the boy, because he was out riding his bicycle, missed the show. He came home for dinner, the anger was over, and the next day, he's outside riding his bicycle, interestingly enough, around the time that dad's supposed to come home, and day after day after day, this would happen. 20 years go by. He's 32. He has a fight with his wife at the end of the day after they both come home from work. And in the middle of the fight, while they're in the kitchen, he stops the conversation, walks out the door, gets in his car, and takes off. Out of the blue. Now I know this because they're coming to see me as a couple. And I'm asking, like, how'd that work for you? You know, it's really never a good, guys, it's really never a good idea to walk out on the woman in the middle of a fight. It's just not a good idea. But he said, well, the reason I did it was because I know how she gets when she gets really angry. And I was worried that I might say something that would really turn the tables in a bad way. What he did not say was, well, I think I walked out because I was having an implicit memory of what it was like for me when my father was an alcoholic and we get angry in the house and I needed to go out on my bicycle in order for me to be safe. And so you see, most of what he was doing wasn't just in response to the fight that he was having with his wife. A lot of what he was implicitly doing was being remembered from stuff he'd been practicing for his whole life. This is an example of things that happen to us all the time. So I've been married for like 2 years, and we go home to Ohio from Pennsylvania to visit with my family. And we get back home, and my wife says, you know, it was really great to be with your family, but while we were there, this guy showed up. You might not have noticed this. He looked like you. He talked like you. But he wasn't you, because I married somebody who was 24, not 14. So I'm the youngest of four sons, and all three of my brothers are much older than me. And I, you know, got treated a little differently when I was a kid. And when I would go home, I would just like slide back into like 14-year-old mode. You know what I mean? Like these things happen all the time. And this implicit memory stuff just shows up all over the place in our life. But we often don't have any idea. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like this guy showed up. Right? So it's not until my wife starts to ask me questions that I have any sense that any of this is even happening. It is the nature of having people in our life by whom we are known that our implicit memory, especially where it creates problems for us, has the potential to be healed. But we're not going to figure that out all by ourselves. By whom are we known, whereby which implicit memory can be healed? And then about the age 18 to 24 months of age, those neurons that are responsible for our capacity to remember time travel, explicit memory, start to come online. And then we can remember things a little more clearly. We can remember what I had for breakfast this morning, where I went on vacation last summer. We can remember these things. What's really difficult for some of us, though, is that we can have experiences in which our implicit and our explicit memory don't match very well. Some of us in this very room, if we were to ask, might answer this question. If I were to say, how much of your life do you remember? You might say, gosh, I remember a lot of my life, maybe back to about age 12 or 13. There are a lot of people in the world who don't have a lot of clear, explicit memory of the first decade of their life. It's fuzzy. They might remember some facts, they might remember some events, but for the most part, they don't remember much about relationships. That has a lot to do with how their brain was wired in relationship while they were growing up during that time. Or this, the woman who is raped while out running. And the rape is so bad that she has a dissociative event and doesn't remember anything about what happens. But then doesn't understand a couple weeks later why it is that when she's out running again and she comes near this space where it happened, that she suddenly is overwhelmed with sheer unadulterated panic. But has no real memory of why this is going on. You see, we can have all kinds of things that take place for us in which our implicit memory gets activated in the context of circumstances for which it just doesn't make sense. Because we think we're in a loving relationship with our spouse or, you know, in our church or in our workplace, and something triggers us that we can't quite get our hands on. What does it mean for these things to be integrated? It's hard work. Narrative. We're going to talk a little later about this idea of attachment. But right now I want to talk a little about storytelling. You see, one of the things that we as human beings do, that as far as we know, no other animals do, is that we tell stories. At least we tell stories the way we do. It's possible that dogs tell stories. They're just not telling us what those stories are that they're telling each other. It may be, you ever seen the Far Side comic, right, where the dog's like talking to them, and then it turns to the human. It's a fascinating thing to think about. But in human development, this is what we eventually do. We eventually tell stories. It's our narrative. We go from this vertical part of our brain and our consciousness and our right and our left part of our brain and our capacity for remembering. And in the course of that, we try to put this stuff together and we make sense of it. What's your story? Here's some features about it that you may or may not have thought about. Number one, your story was being told long before you were ever born. Everybody here in the room, as far as we know, was born of a woman, which means some woman got pregnant with you. And when she got pregnant with you, she started to think about you. My mother was 44 when she got pregnant with me. In 1962, to be pregnant at 44, after your last kid was born 11 years ago, people are wondering, like, Betty, what were you and Lewis thinking? Oh, we know what you were thinking, but like, what were you thinking? If you're 44 in 1962 and you're pregnant, you get worried that your kid is going to be born and they're not going to be okay, because like, it was not very common for women of that age to have babies. The story of me starts to be told anxiously. When your mother was pregnant with you, she started to think things. So did your father. They think things about you that are good. They think things about you that are worthy. All a whole range of different things that are being told about you. And then you're violently born. And they start to tell other things about you. Right? If you're a boy, they start to tell you your name. And you're a girl, your name. But then they put clothes on you. And they put clothes on you that, like, you would never wear if you had a choice. I mean, I know I'm, like, only 6 weeks old, but come on, Mom. Like, don't put me in that. And clothes tell us things about ourselves. You know, especially, like, if you grow up in a family where, like, your parents might not necessarily be, like, in the clothing groove. And, like, even when you're 12, they're putting clothes on you that you would never, like, want. But you see what I mean? Like, people are already telling stories about you. Here's another feature about your story. Most of the way we begin to tell our story, because we take things that we feel and sense and image, and we eventually put language to that. But most of the way we tell our story is not using language. Most of what makes up the storytelling process for us is sensations, images, and feelings. Imagine going to the movie theater to see this new movie, Noah. And when you got there, the only thing that showed up was dialogue. There's no picture, there's no rain, there's no rustle. There's just dialogue. What would that be like? It's not much of a story. If that's what I wanted, I'd like save my money and read it in a book. Most of how we tell stories involves pictures. It involves images, sensations, feelings, all these kinds of things that aren't just about language. And so we then begin to tell that story. And in addition, another feature is that we always tell stories with other people in mind. Other people are always contributing narrative to the narrative that we create. Like, we don't make up our own story by ourselves. We never do. And so one of the questions that's important for us to ask is, who are the voices that are involved in your corporate narrative? Who are they telling you that you are? And then a last feature, these are just a few of them, there are a lot more, but there's a last feature about storytelling. We as human beings eventually learn that we tell stories to be heard. We tell stories to be heard. We don't tell them just to the wall. We tell them because we long to be heard. We long to be heard, which I would suggest bears testimony to the fact that we have been built, we've been made for connection with other people. We don't really have that option. That's what we were made to be. The question is, to what degree am I intentionally living in the way that my brain was made to be lived in? How well am I paying attention to the way I'm telling my story? Because every day I get up, I add to that narrative one more verse. I decide that, like, oh, this is going to be a horrible conversation with this person. That's you telling a story about something that may or may not be true. Why is it that you decide to tell it that way? What are the other features and who are the other voices that are helping you tell that story in that way? If I'm not paying attention to the fact that that's how I'm telling my story will tell itself. And it's tough to love God when my mind has been hijacked. It is important to remember this one thing in particular, too, about storytelling. The gospel is a story. It is the pinnacle of the biblical narrative. And that story has come to intersect yours. And invariably, my story and Jesus' story about my story are going to be in conflict. Because there will be things that I believe are true about me that he's going to, nope, those things aren't true. It's not true that you're not enough. But I keep telling that story over and over again. But there are things that I do and don't want to do. And he's like, no, that's not true either. I want you to do this in order for you to have life. But I don't know how to do that. That's not the story that I've been telling for 40, 50 years. What does it mean for us in community to allow the gospel to be the story that transforms the story we are telling, not just as individuals, but the story, for instance, that we're even telling as this community? What's your story? The next domain is the domain of state. Now, here's what we mean. It's a pretty simple idea. When the springtime arrives here in Saskatoon, like in 3 months, okay, and you go to play tennis. Anybody here play tennis? Play tennis, okay. So when you get ready to play tennis, you put on the clothing that you wear to play tennis. You get your racket. And when you begin the process of even thinking about getting ready to play tennis, you enter into a state of mind that we would say the state of mind of playing tennis. And what we mean by that is, literally, the neural networks in your brain, and as they reach into your body, will begin to be primed to enter into that state. We know how this is. Like, so I start to think about going to the tennis court. I think about what I'm going to wear. I think about a whole range of different things that are involved in playing tennis. But when I'm done playing tennis, and I'm going to then go home, or I'm going to go to an appointment, my brain begins to shift because now I move out of this state of playing tennis into the state of going to the meeting. And that's represented by an entirely different set of neural network firing pathways. State to state to state. All day, every day, we are moving from state to state to state to state. We are transitioning from one state of mind to another. And a lot of what creates trouble for us is what happens in the transition from one state to another. It's like this. I'm at work, where I'm master of the universe. And I forget that I'm changing states to go home where I'm not master of the universe. I still arrive and am behaving as if I'm master of the universe until someone says, honey, could you please stop reading the paper like you want to, like you're the master of the universe, and please help me with the dinner. But that's just... Oh, you're laughing, but it was not funny. It was not funny when that happened. In fact, it's never funny. It keeps repeating itself, but it's never funny. But you see what I mean. We move from one thing that we're doing to something else, and often we're not stopping to recognize consciously, I'm moving into a different place. I'm going to have to be in a different place where I'm having a different kind of conversation with somebody, a different kind of energy. I'm having to be more conscious and attentive to this movement from one state to another. This, again, is work that is required by our attentional mechanism, because so much of our life trouble becomes trouble because I'm not paying attention to the fact that I've moved from one state to another. And it's happening all day. Like, you can tell, we're going to have lots of work for everybody to do by the time this is all done. State integration. Interpersonal integration. It is important to know that all of these things that we've been talking about so far are taking place simultaneously in all those other people around you. And so all this stuff, from consciousness to vertical to horizontal to memory to narrative to state, everybody is trying to do this together. The more able I am to recognize that there are other brains who are working hard to try to do this, the more intentionally we can work to be more interpersonally integrated, more interpersonally connected. If we are more intentionally and consciously attuning to these different domains. So this has significance as far as our body together is concerned. If we were to say, like, look, we're going to be committed to loving God with all of our minds. We're going to be committed to allowing God to transform us, not just as individuals, but in so doing these things, we allow God to transform us as a community. And your larger community in Saskatoon needs this community as a transforming organism. It doesn't just need, like, there's a reason that, like, Paul does not talk about just little individuals. It's the church as an organism. It is you that touches the organism of Saskatoon. It's difficult for us to do that, though, if we're not functioning as integrated body. And I'm only able to do that by attuning to the fact that other people and I are going to do this together. Interpersonal integration. Temporal. This is important. We believe that animals can tell time. And by time, we don't mean like on the clock, but we believe that animals have a sense of, some sense of past and future. Like squirrels have some sense of remembering where they're, like where they put the acorns. But and they know that they need to do this because something's coming. But we're not really thinking that squirrels like have conversations with squirrels about how bad the winter might be that's coming. They're not so worried about what's going to happen to us in the afterlife, as far as we know, squirrels. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't want squirrels in the afterlife. But here's something that's important for us to know. Our brains are constantly anticipating the future. Our brains are just, my brain is one big anticipation machine. It is anticipating where my next foot falls on the floor. Literally. It's also anticipating how soon will Kurt be done so we can get to lunch. It's anticipating, gosh, I'm not really sure if I want to come back this afternoon because he might make me dance again. It's anticipating what we're having for dinner. It's anticipating, will there be work for me in a month when my contract runs out? It's anticipating, I'm not sure that we really have the emotional strength in our tank to take care of our 17-year-old. Constantly anticipating a future. But we also anticipate a long-term future. Everybody in this room lives, whether you know it or not, with an eschatology, with a sense of what's going to happen in the end. And the story of what happens in the end is a story that is an extension of our narrative. But that story, that extension, doubles back and has an effect on where we are right now. If I don't really believe that this is going anywhere, it doesn't really matter to me. But if I really believe that what I do right here, right now, has implication for the new heaven and the new earth that is coming, everything that I do right now matters. But only to the degree that I'm actually paying attention to that temporal future. To what degree do we actually pay attention to our sense that Jesus is coming and what that means? We pay lip service to that. We say that every now and then. We believe that on Sunday morning. But does it mean something to you? Are we attuning to it at 11 o'clock in the morning while I'm at the office? This is hard work, folks, because we live in a world that does not believe this. We live in a world that lives with this plausibility structure that, like, the end of the world is going to be that everything flames out. You have to decide if that's the long-term story you're going to believe. And if so, to what degree will you attune to it to allow it to come back to help you in this integrating process? Last thing before we wrap up for this time. Transpirational. It's a made-up word. It's not a real word. It's a made-up word. My friend Dan Siegel made this up, and this is what he's really trying to get across. We've just talked about 8 different domains. For all we know, there could be 80. We can slice and dice the mind any way we want to. But here's the point. There's no question that these 8 different domains so far, if we are going to do the work we've just talked about doing, is going to require a lot of effort. Yes? To be transpirational means it's working toward being attuned to all of these 8 domains simultaneously. And you're like, how in the world will we do this? I want to suggest to you this. However we want to categorize this, I want to suggest to you that for Jesus, this is what he did. To have the mind of Christ means to have a prefrontal cortex that is this integrated, that is this aware. Do you imagine for a minute, like, what do you imagine he was doing? Up all night, up early in the morning, praying. It's that kind of work that is required of us in order for us to live in the space whereby which we love the Lord our God with everything that our mind consists of. It is hard work. But here's the news. You're going to work hard regardless. Life does not offer us the option of I work hard or I don't work hard. The only options are I work hard and stay in prison or I work hard and go free. You get to decide which kind of work you want to do. When we come back, we're going to talk about what it means, starting with emotion. We're going to talk about what it means for us to begin to apply these things relationally, in real time, in real space. We're really going to look at the role that shame plays in wanting to disrupt our life together as a community, and what it means for Jesus in his story to touch your story so that you, not just as individuals, but as a community, becomes that redemptive healing force, not just for each other, but in your larger extended community here in Saskatoon. Let's pray before we go. God, we're grateful that you have created us the way you have. And we're grateful for Jesus, in whom we have no better picture of who you are. And we pray your mercy on us as we seek to live into what it means to love you with all of our minds, that you may change them, and that you may walk with us into changing the world along the way. Bless now our time of conversation and our meal. And we say all this in the name of Jesus the Christ, our King. Amen.
Just a couple of announcements before you go for lunch. Thank you very much, Kurt. It's been a good morning.